Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio. Mino Studio is a pre- and post-production facility for all of your audio needs. Mino Studio's founder is an accredited audio engineer with top 40 and indie album credits. With over 30 years of music industry experience, Mino Studio can take your podcast from idea to reality. Contact Mino Studio at MinoStudio777@gmail.com for more information. That's Mino Studio spelled M-E-N-O, MinoStudio777@gmail.com.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is a show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes, type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, today we've got a great show. Got with us Paul Moore. Paul Moore is co-founder of Wellings Capital, a commercial multifamily investment firm, and the author of The Perfect Investment, Create Enduring Wealth from the Historic Shift to Multifamily Housing. After graduating with an engineering degree and then an MBA from Ohio State, Paul started on the management development track at Ford Motor Company in Detroit. After 5 years, he departed to start a staffing company with a partner. They sold it to a publicly traded firm 5 years later. Along the way, Paul was finalist for Ernst & Young's Michigan Entrepreneur of the Year 2 years straight. Paul later entered the real estate sector, where he completed over 85 real estate investments and exits and appeared on an HGTV special real estate episode. Rehabbed and managed rental properties, built a number of new homes, developed a waterfront subdivision, and started two successful online real estate marketing firms. Three successful developments, including assisting with development of a Hyatt Hotel and a multifamily housing project, led him into the arena. Paul is married with four children. Well, wow, Paul, you have quite a background there, and it's like you've been a lot of places, and especially in the real estate arena. But I'd love to hear your story from yourself, how you got started and moved into this area.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's great to be on the show. And yeah, I was getting a petroleum engineering degree back in the 80s, and my roommate and I started selling Easter baskets to other college kids, and we actually got somehow the dean's office gave us a list of all the parents addresses, and we actually sent them order forms. They ordered Easter baskets. So I kind of got the entrepreneurial bug way back then. And then during my MBA, I actually made Ghostbusters mouthwash for a small entrepreneur in Columbus, Ohio. And so I got the bug, the entrepreneurial bug, fairly early on. When I went to Ford Motor Company, after being there about a month, though I really enjoyed Ford, I started looking for other entrepreneurial things to do on the side. We started a property tax consulting firm. We looked at starting an oil change shop in Farmington Hills, Michigan. And eventually, my buddy and I started a human resource outsourcing firm in Michigan. 5 years later, we sold that to a publicly traded firm. And my wife and I were trying to decide, do we want to stay right on the edge of Metro Detroit as it was honestly caving in economically at the time, or do we want to move to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia? So it was a hard choice, but we actually decided to move to Virginia, which is where I am now. We opened a nonprofit ministry to connect with international students studying at various universities in the United States. We brought them out and got them an opportunity to ride on a goat and fish in a pond and take pictures of hot dogs at dinner. It was just a lot of fun. But honestly, going into semi-retirement in your mid-30s sounds exciting, but I got really bored really quick. And a friend of mine moved to our area from another city, and he got bored pretty quickly too. And we decided to start flipping houses. And that led me on to about a 17-year journey. And I learned a lot of things I never learned in college. And actually, it's honestly, a lot of things I would never want to repeat, a lot of lessons that were very painful. And one of the reasons I wrote this book was so that people could stand on my shoulders and not make the same mistakes I made. Because honestly, Bill, if I'd only known, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago about commercial multifamily investing, I never would have done anything else. So I didn't start in commercial multifamily, though. Like you said, I did a lot of house flips. The first one right out of the gate, we went to an auction on an icy day near Roanoke here. And we were the only people at the auction. We bought this house for $30,000 less than it was worth, and it was only worth $60,000. And we painted it, cleaned it, put a little for sale by owner sign them in the yard, and sold it in 4 hours for about a $24,000 profit. And we were on our way. But I didn't know at that point that flipping houses is generally not a path, at least in my mind, for passive cash flow, passive income. And so we did dozens and dozens of houses. And I actually got into flipping waterfront lots. I know it sounds funny, but we're here near a beautiful Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia. And there were lots that people had purchased back in the 70s and 80s for $20,000, $50,000 that were now worth $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. And so we would buy the lot, clear the trees out, clear the underbrush, put a park bench there, get a dock permit, and sell it for $100,000 profit or more in a few months. That was a lot of fun. But then the downturn hit. And so we had built, I didn't mention this, we had built some modular homes along the way. We had developed a waterfront subdivision. But when the housing crunch hit, I found myself $2.5 million in debt. And I'll tell you more about that later. But later, when the oil and gas boom hit in North Dakota, like I said, I had a petroleum engineering background. My partner and I invested in oil and gas in North Dakota. And he has a small jet. Every time he would fly from his home in Colorado Springs to North Dakota, there was no place to stay. There was no hotels. He had to fly back to Colorado or to another city, like in South Dakota or Wyoming, to get a hotel room. So this was 2010. We decided, we both had some real estate background, so we decided to build a multifamily facility. And so we built that very quickly. I personally worked with him to lease that up to full capacity, and then we expanded it later. We were leasing 300 square foot furnished efficiency rooms for $3,900 a month. I didn't know what cap rate was at the time, but we were basically operating at a 50% cap rate.
Oh, my gosh. And,
basically, it was enough. And these were two oil workers working for Halliburton, Schlumberger, other drilling companies. The alternative was these people sleeping in their car. They were working 12-hour days, 6 days a week in some cases. And they were sleeping in their trucks, sleeping in their cars, sleeping at rest stops. And we were basically giving them a beautiful, safe place to live. And we did that for a number of years. Then we actually built a Hyatt hotel for a lot of the oil executives who were flying into Minot, North Dakota from Texas. And they, you know, had their Hyatt gold cards, and we gave them a very nice place. It's actually, Hyatt tells us it's the nicest Hyatt house in the United States. We built that in Minot, North Dakota. I'm still a partial owner of that. So that's what we did in North Dakota. About the time I turned 50, though, I realized that the ups and even though the multifamily facility that we built there was very profitable, very successful, we ended up selling that at the height of the boom, and I'm glad we did. But the risk and return profile of the Hyatt Hotel, the waterfront lots, the modular homes I built, it was not something I wanted to continue through my 50s, 60s, 70s, because I didn't want to be, if I continued to play double or nothing, I realized that, you know, when I stop working someday, I might end up with nothing. And it wasn't a sustainable strategy. So decided that I really wanted to find something that was much safer, had much better passive cash flow, wouldn't have a 300% return of an oil well. By the way, we made nothing on that oil investment. We're still waiting for that to pan out. But basically decided that after investigating it, we realized that the safety and the stability and the profitability of the multifamily sector was something that we basically had not experienced in all the other businesses we started. So that's how I got into multifamily.
So how economically is that area still strong? I mean, or was there a downturn after you sold?
Yeah, well, we built the nicest multifamily facility in the Williston, Watford City area in North Dakota. And our plan was that we would be the last one standing if oil prices turned down. Of course, everybody knew that oil prices would never drop below $100 a barrel again. And that was right before they went down into the 30s. Right. And so, yes, there was a tremendous downturn. A lot of it's a ghost town now. And it turns out that the facility that we built, which is called Bakken Residence Suites, is still about 50 or 60% occupied, which is much better than the competitors there who have pretty much shut down.
Wow. Wow. And they're all efficiency units, too. Is that true? Or studios?
Yeah, they're all efficiencies. They have a kitchen, living room. Some of them have private bedrooms. Some of them just have the efficiency model.
Right. Wow. So there must have been a certain point that, as you mentioned, when you're turning 50, that you saw that there, that this kind of, almost like when you were flipping, I'm sure, and that's a long time to flip, 17 years. Wow. I mean, that's a lot of work, turning over properties like that on a regular basis. But you're at a point where you're saying, well, I really want something more passive. You already had a sort of a passive income generator that you had built. And so it was at that point where you really realized that's where you wanted to focus your efforts then.
Right. Yeah. Well, someone said if you're a millionaire by the time you're 40, but blow it all by age 50, you've really gained nothing except the opportunity to start all over again. And I just realized that, I haven't told you about several other things I did, including starting a wireless internet company, building a commercial office building, a real high-end building in Colorado Springs. I was a minority partner on that. A lot of these things I did, just they had a lot of glitter. They were shiny objects, but they weren't safe, stable, predictable. And honestly, like I said, it was an opportunity to take a big risk. A lot of people think, Bill, that high risk is proportional to high return. And that's not really true. High risk is proportional to high return or very low return. And it's really important to understand that the more risk you take, you're actually, you know, you're not just automatically going to get a great return. And the oil wells I invested in near in North Dakota were proof of that. They were supposed to have a 300-500% return, and they've had exactly zero return as of now, and a lot of headache. And I just realized I didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to leave my kids with nothing, and I wanted something that was very stable, very safe, and that's how I got into multifamily.
Wow. Yeah, in your book, I know you referenced that, the idea of, you know, if you're going to go to Vegas and you're just going to keep doubling down, eventually you're going to lose it all.
Right.
And, you know, that the idea of moving into something that is more stable, you know, I don't know if you can ever say anything is safe, but, but definitely more stable, a lot more sustainable, you know, obviously sounds like it was a smart move on your part. You came to this realization, this is sort of your light bulb moment, and you're going to go in that. So how did you sort of redirect your efforts at that point? Did you started looking, zeroing in on markets? How did you sort of begin that effort?
Right. Well, the first thing I did is I started reading books on apartments, reading books on multifamily, and I started dialing in specifically on commercial multifamily because the economies of scale at, let's say, 75 to 100 units or more are much higher, as you know, than a lot of the small multifamily complexes that you can get into. The first thing I did was I actually found an off-market deal in my town, and it had six units, and the owner was fully occupied, and the owner came and met me on a Saturday morning, and she looked really tired, and she said, you know, I said, why do you want to sell this? It's fully occupied. It seems like a good investment. She said, I'm just tired. I'm tired of dealing with tenants. I'm tired of 2 a.m. phone calls. I'm just tired. And she said, you've been in real estate a long time. You should do fine. And I thought, I need to look into this a little bit more. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized I wanted to go into commercial multifamily, which again is about 75, 100 units or more, where the economies of scale, as one of your other guests said, are much stronger. Mm-hmm. So that's what I decided to do. The first thing I did is I went out and got a mentor. I found somebody else who had been doing this for about 8 years, and they had a lot of experience, and I actually studied under them for about a year and a half. Wow. And I was really glad that I did that, and I highly recommend for people to get training, and that was kind of, it was a great opportunity for me to learn the ropes.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's one of the things that we strongly advise people as well, you know, besides, you know, just getting the basic root education and really starting to zero in on your goals, is the importance of mentor. But it's also, I think, one of the things that people struggle the most with. Maybe you could tell us, you know, how do you go about finding a mentor?
Well, I mean, if you're on a low budget, one thing you can do is just buy good books and really, you know, apply what you learn. Another thing you can do is Michael Blanc he's a Bigger Pockets contributor. You probably know him. He's got a great program for about $1,000, I think it is. You can join his program. He's got a great training program. I've never done it, but I know Mike, and I think he does a great job. There's another company called 37th Parallel. They're in Richmond, Virginia. They've got a $25,000 mentorship program, and that's something that's very intense and provides a whole lot of training, a whole lot of education. So those are three levels right there, and there's all kinds of things in between, I'm sure.
Right. Well, looking at getting started, so you got the education, you've found yourself a mentor. You started buying, I assume, at that point. Do you remember sort of your first major apartment purchase?
Well, the first major one was the apartment building that we built before we really knew what we were doing. Now we had a commercial office building in Colorado Springs. We had the Hyatt Hotel. The one that we built, like I said, I had no real education. When someone asked me for a copy of our rent roll, when we were going to sell this multifamily property, I didn't even know what he meant. So, it was kind of funny that we, and again, that kind of shows you the high risk nature of what we did. I mean, developing it from the ground up in an unstable economic environment wasn't the smartest thing, even though it turned out really well. So that's why I'm glad to be involved in Class B value add apartments at this point.
You're not developing them anymore. I mean, you're buying way. Existing buildings, right?
So yes. Yeah.
Okay. Great. What would you say in that process as you got started, and you've been doing this for a while now, what was sort of one of your biggest mistakes that you encountered in that process that you really learned from?
Well, I think the biggest mistake I made in business in general was getting a copy of the 2005 Fortune magazine that said the real estate market, the cover story. I wish I could remember the exact what it was, what it said, but the cover story said the real estate market is about to implode. I mean, it was a big cover story. And of course, I was making $100,000 per waterfront lot, flipping these lots and making money flipping houses, building modular homes, and I ignored it. And just ignoring those warning signs is something that I really never want to do again. Like I said, I found myself $2.5 million in debt in right in the depth of the Great Recession. And so that was probably the biggest mistake I made. Another mistake was chasing shiny objects, as you could say. In the middle of the time we were doing the multifamily and the Hyatt Hotel in North Dakota, we heard that a lot of companies up there needed wireless internet. And so we partnered up with a friend of a friend who had a wireless internet company. And we started a wireless internet company that's still limping along. I'll tell you the truth. It's still just barely making a profit. But honestly, it's never performed the way it should. And the lesson there was, don't chase high profits in areas that you know nothing about. Right. That worked with the apartments, and I think that was providential that it did, but it did not work with the wireless internet company. It did not work with the oil and gas investment, and so I wouldn't do that again.
Now, how did you pull out of the $2 million loss? I mean, that had to be a tough thing to transition from.
Well, I was $2.5 million in debt, and it was the fall of 2007. And even though the economy had not gone into full recession nationally, we were fairly close to D.C., and we were already in a full-blown recession because Smith Mountain Lake, the property in general, but especially building lots, had just gone through the floor. And I was sitting on a Sunday morning, and I was crying out to God saying, you know, I don't know what to do. I need help. And I felt like God directed me to a man named George Mueller. George Mueller is one of my heroes. He built orphanages.
You're seeing
in
here.
England.
Yeah.
Big, oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Big time.
Well, So George, and I know it's technically pronounced Mueller since you know him, so you probably know that. But anyway, he built orphanages, and he housed, I think it was a total of, I don't want to say how many, but it was thousands of orphans, and he did it all by faith. And they say that in today's dollars, he raised something like $170, $180 million over his lifetime, all through prayer, all through trusting God. And so I felt like the Lord said to me one morning fairly clearly, what would George Mueller do if he was $2.5 million in debt? Now, you know, and I know he never would have been in debt.
Exactly.
But that's where I found myself. And so I went out and read some more about him, and I realized he actually had a lot to say to people in business and a lot to say to people in marketing. He actually didn't believe in advertising. It was interesting. But I came to the conclusion that George Mueller would give his way out of debt. In other words, he would basically stand on his principles. He would continue to be generous. He would maybe he would even increase his giving, and he would trust God to do something miraculous. So on January 1st, 2008, I called my family together and I said, guys, we're in big trouble. I've got one or two friends who are telling me that we need to declare bankruptcy. There's just no way out of this. I said, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to start giving a lot more aggressively than we have in the past. And we're going to see what God's going to do. You watch, he's going to do something. That was January 1st, 2008. the recession had hit fully here, like I said. And around January 27th or 28th, 4 weeks into this, we were actually giving a certain weekly amount, Bill. And it was as if we were making a lot of money, but we weren't. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it was pretty foolish on paper. But I ran into a guy at a Subway restaurant, and this guy was a real estate developer, and he made an offhanded comment that I felt like I had to follow up on. And the bottom line is, I used his offhanded comment to go to the County Planning and Zoning Board and to basically utilize one of their laws openly to be able to subdivide a large tract of waterfront land I had that they said was not subdividable. And they said, well, you're right. Actually, if you do it that way, you can subdivide it. And 13 months later, I was completely debt-free.
Wow. Wow. Well, my next question was going to be, what was your biggest success? And I mean, to me, it sounds like that may be it. But wow, that is amazing. Yeah.
Yep, wow. It was. And the reason it's my biggest success, I think, is not just the money, although that was great. It was the story, because now I have a testimony to tell my kids, my grandkids, and everybody from now on that, you know, if you stand on principles and you do what is right versus what makes sense, hopefully, though, it'll make sense and be right. But in that case, it made no sense on paper, but it was right, and it was what God was leading. And when I did that, it worked out amazingly well.
Oh, that's what a great story. Yeah, Mueller is a hero here. You know, I love the stories where he would be sitting with all these orphans at a table, and there's absolutely no food in the cupboard. They're all sitting around the table waiting to eat, and he basically says, "We don't have any food. Let's just pray." And, you know, there'd be a knock on the door and somebody would show up. I mean, this just didn't happen once. This happened multiple times, you know. And, you know, as a family that lived on faith for, you know, over 20 years, you know, definitely is a great story. Thanks for sharing
that. You bet.
Well, you know, we have a lot of folks that are listening in all different stages of life. We have some that are, you know, that are younger, you know, they're just kind of starting out. We have those that are sort of approaching retirement that, you know, are looking at their finances and saying, gee, you know, I'm concerned that we might not have what we need to be able to make it. And then there are those that are in retirement that are either, you know, just surviving, or, you know, they're doing okay, but they're also, you know, they're looking at other ways to be able to supplement their income. So what advice could you give to these folks? You know, again, it's quite a range. You've got those on fixed incomes and some that are maybe in a little healthier situation, but what advice would you give them in terms of getting started in generating passive income?
So, I generally have a propensity to take risk, as you can tell. And my advice would be, if you're in your 20s, if you have extra money to burn, take your risks while you're young. And that would be my advice. That's actually the advice of one of my mentors. And I really believe that. However, my advice in general would be for most people, and especially the older people get, would be, don't swing for the fences. I really believe that swinging the fences is just going to cause strikeouts at inopportune times. And I really believe that it's not a sustainable strategy for most people over the long haul. I mean, think about these two people. Imagine which one of these stories do you think will be told in blogs and bars and real estate clubs? First of all, you've got Johnny. Johnny bought a home for 45 cents on the dollar. And then while renovating it, he realized he could rezone it commercially, and he went on to sell it for four times what he paid. Or contrast Johnny to Gary. Gary and his son begin quietly building apartments or renovating existing apartments, and they built that business up for years, and they never made a killing. They never made 200-400% in 1 year like Johnny, but they eventually became one of the wealthiest families in town just by growing wealth slowly. Johnny's story, the first guy, never mentioned the fact that he, you know, had a slam dunk deal that went south. He had a quick flip that turned into a slow nightmare. He ended up delivering pizzas till he got back on his feet. So my advice would be, you know, to follow Solomon's advice. He says, wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it. That's in Proverbs 13:11. So I think that would be my best advice.
That's great. Well, looking at your current business, and it seems like it's very well established, what is sort of your goal in your life as you're maybe looking maybe at retirement, maybe not, maybe, but what's sort of the vision you have for the future of your company and where you'd like to see things?
I think the answer to that is that we are looking to add several thousand doors to our portfolio over the next several years. My personal goal is, honestly, all three of the major partners in my company are making money right now. I have a website at Smith Mountain Lake. It's called smithmountainhomes.com, and I'm making a good living from that. I generate thousands of real estate leads every year, and I pass those along to seven agents. And when they close on a residential property at Smith Mountain Lake, I get to share the revenue, the commission from that. But all three of the partners have other businesses. We're making enough money right now. So the truth is, we are all very passionate. As people who are in our, you know, 50s, we're passionate about doing something that will change the world. And one of the things we're passionate about is rescuing victims of human trafficking. And what we want to do is we want to give our investors a safe, stable, profitable return. But we want the investors to get involved with us, helping us direct what we do with our internal profits. And so I want to be clear, my investors will all get all their ROI, and we generally shoot for a, you know, similar ROI to what many of your guests have said, you know, 15 to 20% annually per year in total. But as far as our internal profits, we want to give 25 to 50% to fight human trafficking. I don't know if you've heard the statistics on human trafficking, but there's hundreds of thousands of people impacted by this in the U.S. every year. There's 2 to 4 million victims of it worldwide every year. 50% of the victims are estimated to be children. And there are, they estimate that there are something like 20 million slaves or trafficked victims in the world right now. And I just can't, Bill, I cannot find this acceptable on my watch. And so I want to do what I can to basically use the profits that I have control of internally to fight human trafficking and to rehabilitate victims. So that's kind of my ultimate goal. I plan to work 40 some more years to do this, and I'm hoping I kind of started late with this goal. And so now I've got some time to make up. And so that's what I plan to do.
That's great. Well, you know, we were talking offline before I mentioned to you that it's something we witnessed, you know, firsthand, and that in our orphanage in Haiti, we have had a number of children that were caught up in child slavery there. And so I can, I'm very humbled by what your plan is. That's just awesome. Really, really neat.
Thanks.
Well, this time is zipped by, and totally to my dismay here, because I have like a million questions I could ask you right now. And I'm sure there's a lot that people have too, because I think it's really nice about your book is you go into a lot of detail about where you should focus your efforts to really create passive income in multifamily. And so I think there's a lot of good detail, and I try to avoid that because I think it would have, you know, we would have been on the phone for a couple hours here, but but I do really advise people, and I want to let people know too that there'll be a link to the book so you guys could obtain your own copy and so forth from Paul, but definitely a lot of great information in there. So we're kind of moving into what we call our wrap it up stage here, and this is where I ask you a series of quick questions hopefully you'll share some good information for folks that can use that, especially if they're in that education stage and trying to get more informed. So I'll ask them quick, and hopefully you'll answer fairly quick too, and we'll go from there. Are you ready, Paul?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay. How about your favorite real estate book?
I'd recommend The Complete Guide to Buying and Selling Apartment Buildings by Steve Burgess, with this caveat. Steve is very, very aggressive on the time frame to flip assets. And if you take that time frame and double it instead of a year, maybe make it 2 to 3 years, it's a fantastic book.
Great. How about your favorite just general business book?
My favorite book is Made to Stick by Chip and Dan Heath.
Great. Also, how about, you know, we introduced this previous episode and want to bring it back here. So how about a favorite quote?
C.S. Lewis said, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We're half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased."
Wow, that's a great, great quote. And if you have that committed to memory, I'm very impressed here, because I don't think my memory would be able to handle that. But that's a great quote, great quote. How about your most valuable website for your efforts that you do in real estate?
I really like Neighborhood Scout. NeighborhoodScout.com is a paid service that allows you to go in and dial in on crime statistics, real estate statistics, schools in a given neighborhood. I also like Google Earth for the same reason.
Yeah, that's great too. How about favorite app? Do you have anything on your phone that that has been valuable for you?
Well, honestly, my favorite app on my iPhone is my podcast app, because I get to listen to great podcasts like the Old Dogs REI Network.
Okay, I'll pay you after this, Paul. Thanks. Thanks for the plug. Okay, and our final wrap-it-up question here. If something cataclysmic happened, and I think you could probably speak from experience on this one, and you lost everything, and all you had in the bank was $1,000, how would you recreate your real estate business, your cash flow, with just that $1,000 in the bank?
Well, I would absolutely target getting back into multifamily, but I don't know if I'd start there. I think I would place an ad in Craigslist, try to find a home that I could purchase quickly or get under contract quickly for, $100 and wholesale it back out. Another thing I think I would do would be, I think I would try to get a lease option sandwich under contract, which basically means that I would rent to own a house that was in pre-foreclosure. I would turn around, clean it up, paint it, get the guy out, and then rent to own it to someone else. And I would take the down payment and the monthly profit. And that's what I would do for some cash flow. And then, of course, I would try as quickly as I could to get into an owner-financed multifamily apartment.
Great. First time I've ever heard that lease option sandwich. That's great. Very interesting. Good creative. I love talking to folks like you that have come in from different angles on so many of these deals. It's great. Wow. Well, this has been a great conversation. And like I said, I could probably continue asking questions here, but I know there's some point you probably have to go back to work or home or what have you. So, but how can people reach you? If people did have questions and they wanted to find out more information, how would they be able to do that?
Well, you can reach us through our website, which is Wellings, WELLINGS, capital.com. That's WellingsCapital.com. My email address is paul@WellingsCapital.com. You could also call us at 1-800-844-2188.
Ah, great. Being a guest on our show, just so you're aware, we are called the Old Dogs REI Network, and none of our guests get to leave without giving us their best old hound dog howl. Now, no pressure here. Even though we are talking about actually having a contest at the end of the year, and people can evaluate these howls, and our guests will get some amazing prize. So,
okay.
But I don't want you to feel too pressure.
No pressure. No pressure. Okay. All right. Here goes.
Okay. Oh, that was good, Paul. That was really good. Okay.
Thank you.
Definitely going to make it into at least the quarterfinals. That's all I can say at this point. But
excellent. Excellent.
Really good. Wow.
All right.
Well, Paul, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and sharing information. I would love to ask you back and maybe dig into some details on some things real estate investing related. But I think it was a great overview. You had a lot of good information there. And I also think there's a lot of good things that people can take home with them that'll help them in their real estate investing endeavors. So I do want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Also, I want to thank all our old dog listeners out there for joining us today. We know there's a lot of other things you could be doing, and the fact that you've taken the time to listen to our podcast really means a lot to us, and we greatly appreciate it. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. And until next time, keep moving forward, and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.